Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thanks for coming out tonight and supporting your local and independent bookstore. Tonight we have Mark Stevens and Mike Keefe, and they're here to discuss Asphalt Warrior by the late Gary Reilly. It's always really great to have... Go ahead. It's always great to have local authors showcased here because Denver really does have a vibrant literary community. And so we always really appreciate it when these kind of events come our way. So with that being said, would you help me in welcoming Mike and Mark?
I'm glad to see you all here tonight. Those of you who knew Gary would know that he would have hated this. He would have absolutely hated it. He hates crowds, and you know this was not his thing. I'd like to thank the Tattered Cover for making this event possible, and thanks to Nick Zellinger and his early design work, and especially to Linda, Myra, Rebecca, and Travis of Big Earth Publishing, and the illustrator John Scherfius for helping produce this fine book. I want to tell you a little bit about my friend Gary. I met him 35 years ago in a film class at UCD. I found that we had a few things in common. We were both vets, and we were going back to school on the GI Bill, and we both enjoyed animation. So we collaborated on a couple of cartoon shorts. The first one was about a vampire with dental troubles. It was called Transylvania Toothache. The second was called AM, and that one actually ended up in the Denver International Film Festival. Working with Gary, I discovered what an incredibly creative guy he was. And then I learned that while he loved filmmaking, writing was his main passion. He had already had a short story published in the IRO Review, and that story went on to be anthologized in the Pushcart Prize Awards of 1979. He had also begun to accumulate a trunk full of manuscripts. He'd written a number of novels before I met him, and then over the years, he'd let me read some of his manuscripts, and they were good. They were good novels, and they kept getting better. We became friends. We spent a lot of time together. I got to know his longtime sweetheart, Sherry Peterson. Where is Sherry? Sherry right here, a sweet and generous soul. I got to know a bit about Gary's background. He came from a large Irish Catholic family, seven brothers and sisters. They bounced around between Kansas, Nebraska, and Colorado. He graduated from Holy Family, is that right? Yeah. And shortly afterwards, he was drafted in the Army. And the circumstances he never told me about. And I only learned about this about a year ago, and this is remarkable. Originally, Gary was slated to serve in Hawaii. His brother Craig, who'd already graduated from college, had orders for Vietnam. Somehow, I don't know how this happened, I'd like to hear the details, Gary arranged for those assignments to be changed, and Gary went to Vietnam instead. That, of course, was a huge, big-hearted gesture. However, I think Gary had ulterior motives. He's a writer looking for material. He was discharged, and he started work on a novel based on his time as a military policeman in Vietnam. He trashed that first attempt and started over. He ended up writing several novels based on that experience, and I read at least two of them, and those two rank among the best of that era. He majored in English at CSU and later at UCD. After graduation, he drove a cab for a while and also worked as a writer for RE/MAX's in-house real estate publication. But the corporate life was not Gary Riley. He quit and turned to writing novels full-time. About then, in the mid-90s, my wife and I were putting together a cartoon and humor site, and Gary started writing an advice column in the persona of Murph, a Denver cab driver. Readers would hop in his taxi, his virtual taxi, tell him their troubles, and seek his wisdom and wit. It was a funny feature, and in the 2.5 years that that feature was on AOL, it generated 1 million words of give and take. 1 million words. Let me give you a couple examples of what he would do. For example, somebody would write in. They'd be stepping in his cab, and this one was from Curly Q. "Hey, Murph, I have this problem. My hair is way too curly. I don't know of anything to do with it. Any suggestions?" Curly Q, "I'm intrigued by the nature of your problem. It makes me wonder exactly what it is that your hair is too curly for. Offhand, I can't think of any human activity that can be thwarted or in some way hindered by the curliness of hair. At any rate, you asked a question and I will answer it. There was once a comic strip called Nancy, drawn by Ernie Bushmiller. Every so often, Nancy's friend Sluggo would play a trick on her. He would put on a scary mask and jump out from behind a fence and frighten her. As this scenario unfolded, Nancy's hair would stick straight out. Ernie must have drawn her hair with a ruler, it was so straight. And unfortunately, Ernie died a few years back, but I believe Sluggo is still alive and resides in San Luis Obispo. Perhaps you could get in touch with him and work out a deal. Sluggo always did seem like the sort of wastrel who would do anything for a buck." Let me do one more. He'd get all kinds of questions. Sometimes they were very serious personal relationship questions, and he handled them well, but always with humor. And other times he'd get just oddball things. Here's one from Aimless 183. "Hey, Murph, I've been perplexed by something for years, and you're the only one I've found who not only listens to crazy questions, but actually has enough insight to maybe figure out a reasonable answer. My question is this. Since I'm so ticklish, it's scary. I jump before anyone even lays a finger on me. Why can't I tickle myself?" Well, here's what Murph had to say. "I decided to send this question to Murph's lab before attempting an answer, which consisted of trying to tickle myself while waiting in the cab line at the airport. I became so engrossed in the experiment that I didn't notice that a number of other cabbies had gathered around my taxi and were watching me. I started on my ribs and I had worked my way down to the bottom of my right foot when I looked up and noticed I had an audience. I was barefoot with one sock draped over the steering wheel and my shirt was open. Well, to make a long story short, the cab supervisor showed up and I was suspended for a week pending a psychiatric evaluation. I would like to say, though, that you were right. I wasn't able to tickle my ribs, although dragging my fingernails across the sole of my bare foot produced some rather intriguing results, which I intend to explore further after they remove the straitjacket." This is the character that Gary took into fiction. When that gig ended, Gary transferred Murph to the novels that we're talking about tonight. The first novel was The Asphalt Warrior, the first of 11 in a series. When he finished one, he would bind it himself and in paperback and give it to me to read. I'd pass it on to my kids. My son, Brady, back here, was a student at CSU at the time. He and his girlfriend would stay up all night reading Murph novels out loud to each other, laughing until dawn. His grades suffered. I still hold Gary personally responsible. All the while, Gary's manuscripts were piling up. His friends, like Mark and me, were constantly on his case to get an agent. Once in a while, he'd give it a half-hearted try. But he didn't have the self-promotion gene. He just wanted to write and polish and create. About 3 years ago, he was diagnosed with cancer. We still got together as usual, talking about books and movies. And I often drove him to the hospital for chemo. He never complained. His spirits were always high. He was always looking forward. With over 22 finely polished novels in that trunk at home, he finally started taking the idea of publication seriously. But he ran out of time. He passed away in March of 2011. Gary left a three-line will, remarkably brief for a guy who is a writer. One line gave Mark Stevens and me permission to pursue publication of his work on behalf of Sherry. So now Mark and I, as Running Meter Press, in association with Big Earth Publishing and Boulder, are bringing Gary Reilly to the reading public. For the first time. At last. Enjoy, I know you all will. Now please welcome Mark Stevens, all-around great guy, bandmate, he's my bass player, and author of the novels Antler Dust and Buried by the Rhone, a Colorado Book Award finalist. Oh, and that book happens to be dedicated to Gary Reilly. Here's Mark Stevens to tell you why.
Thank you, Mike. In case you didn't know, that was Mike Keefe, who was awarded a Pulitzer Prize last year for editorial cartooning, one of many awards he was honored with over 36 years at the Denver Post. I would also like to thank all the folks from Big Earth, Linda, Myra, Travis, everybody, the whole team, and Nick Zellinger as well, John Scherfius as well, and I don't know if John's here tonight or not, but if those aren't, if that isn't one of the most gorgeous drawings for a cover I've ever seen, especially with the Denver detail, and the Ticket to Hollywood poster is downstairs, the second book, so take a look on the way out tonight. Absolutely gorgeous. That's coming out in just a few months, so thank you, John. Fiction, to me, was the air that Gary Reilly breathed. He cared about stories, and he cared about how stories are put together more than anybody I've ever met. And that's saying something. I'm not sure the exact year I met Gary, but it was one night in about 2004, I believe. Gary used to come to hear Falling Rock, the band that Mike and I both play in. And we're playing tomorrow night in Golden. You all are invited. If you need details, see me after the night tonight. Gary used to come here Falling Rock, as I said. Gary didn't come very often. Crowds were definitely not his scene. We'd meet at Cafe Europa on South Pennsylvania Street for our writing discussions, and he called it Europa State University, one of the nicest coffee shops in town. We'd spend hours talking books and stories and writing. It's a cliche to say you loved words. Yes, Gary loved words, but mostly he liked words all strung together so they'd create a story. And so the story had the power to transport you to another place and another time. We started exchanging manuscripts. At the time, I hadn't been published. I only had 4 finished manuscripts to share with him. I started reading all that he had produced, about 16 or 17 books at the time, and a few more that Gary finished over the next 7 years. Reading the Murph series, I knew we'd be here at the Tattered Cover someday. Of course, I fully expected Gary to be here. The Murph stories were so good, so powerful, I was sure I could help Gary find a publisher. Reading a Murph story puts you in a very special place. I believe Murph is an antidote for our times. He is anti-materialism. He is low maintenance. He is very smart and well-read, but he has no need to reveal that fact. He's humble, and he very much wants to be alone. But ultimately, Murph is a human being, and human beings help each other. So Murph is the reluctant hero pulled into the undertow of society where he must deal face-to-face, one-on-one with others. Ultimately, he can't help himself. Murph lives in the city, thrives in the city, and probably knows in his heart he's bound by his own code to help others, just as Gary did for me. I think The Asphalt Warriors are a terrific book, and it's where it all starts, but in my mind, the Murphs just keep getting better and better. Gary read drafts of all my projects, offered endless and detailed feedback. He suggested a key idea for the new book I was working on, which ultimately became Buried by the Rhone. He gave me the central idea for the third in the series, which I'm working on now. Occasionally, we would just start brainstorming plots. There's a storyline loosely known as Majorca that I'd like to write someday. Those sessions at Europa State University never lasted long enough for Gary. I was always the one who had to run after, say, an hour or two. I envied Gary's sense of time. Time with Gary made the world slow down. True, Sherry? How many fiction writers here tonight? Okay, so for the five of you, this is for you. I'd boil his writing lessons down to three. Think through every word. Really think it through. Study the word. Be with the word. Contemplate each and every one. But don't let the word issues bog down the storytelling. The story matters most. That's lesson number one. Number two, become obsessed with fiction. Obsession can be a good thing. Obsession can be healthy. Embrace it and enjoy it. Third, consider all possibilities in your plot. Go to extremes just to see how it sounds or feels, and then dial it back to your own taste. You don't have to tell all the wild stories that occur in the dream it up process, but you might find something you like. In some ways, Gary's approach to fiction was a paradox. Be highly detailed and approach every word with a great deal of careful, close analysis, like a watchmaker studying every moving part. But stay loose and relaxed and open to a world of possibilities, like a wild-eyed inventor. Kind of like a golf swing. Focus, 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 but stay relaxed. In addition to the MRFs, it's no wonder that Gary wrote several tightly wound psychological thrillers and several books that lived in the blurry area between science fiction and fantasy. I could never impart my lessons to promote his work, to network, email, network some more back to him. So the sessions at Europa State University weren't exactly a fair trade. There's really no way to capture those sessions with Gary, but I'd like to try. And I'd like to put his voice in the room tonight by reading a few of his emails to me over the years to capture some of the flavor. Note the care he was putting into reading and editing and polishing, and note the sparkling imagination. There's no replacing that. February 12, 2010. Mark, I want to talk to you further about changing the ending. I think it should be more cinematic. And it occurred to me that the buffalo ought to come into play, i.e., how would Clint Eastwood and Sandra Bullock use a herd of buffalo to enhance the violence of a wild ending? Just as you used elk hides and antler dust, I think you should incorporate the buffalo in some way. They are large, spooky animals. Perhaps a stampede or a scene where Allison has to run into the herd to hide from the villains. Related to this, I was wondering if you would consider coming up with a title like Buffalo Coffin or something along that line to match the weird title of Antler Dust. Weird titles could be one of your trademarks. I do favor Buried by Their Own over everything else so far. The word burial gives it that ominous touch, but it might be worth it to think about working the word buffalo into the title. Coffin, casket, cemetery, plastic, tombstone, things related to the grave. I will play around with words and see what I come up with. Gary. February 25th, 2010. I have to start a new regimen of chemo Monday, so I would like to cancel our tentative Saturday meeting. This will give me time to go over the manuscript one more time before I send you the final copy. Let me know if the cancellation works or whether there was anything specific you wanted to discuss at Europa State University. March 6, 2010. As you probably know by now, I get insane ideas at all hours of the day and night, many of them having to do with writing. None of them having to do with anything else, I'll tell you that. And it occurred to me this morning that it would be interesting if you could somehow incorporate the ultralight airplane into the end of Buried by Their Own. I think it was Shakespeare who said, if an ultralight appears in Act One of a play, it has to stampede the buffalo in Act Three. I actually have no specific scene in mind, but the plane is such a great element that I think it would be worthwhile to come up with a way for Devo's supplier to play some role in the climax of the book. I think it would give the story a nice rounded out feeling. I will leave it at that for now. Feel free to phone me anytime you want to discuss writing. If I'm around, I will pick up landline or cell. Gary. March 12, 2010. Mark, I had an idea about the buffalo stampede that I wanted to pass along. What if Rayburn is trampled by the buffalo, ends up in the river, and Allison has to dive in to save him from drowning? This would make a nice ironic connection with her LaGuardia incident and could bring a form of closure to her post-traumatic stress because she saves a victim who is floating helpless in the water just as she had been a helpless victim. That's exactly the way I wrote it. June 16, 2010. I believe this is the last one. Let me just check real quick. Yeah, this is the last one. There's a Raymond Chandler reference at the end, so hopefully you'll know your Raymond Chandler, because this one kills me. I'll try to make it through. One of the things that I wanted to discuss with you at our canceled workshop was the idea you had a couple years ago about putting the MRFs on a website and sending codes to agents and so forth. I told you I wanted to think about it first, but now that I have cancer, I do not know how long I will be around. And the fact I have wanted to put book one on the net, I wanted to ask you what the logistics of that whole idea consisted of. I was leafing through my MRFs over the weekend and thinking that these books are worth getting out to the public in some manner, even if it means forgetting traditional publishing and experimenting with internet publishing, that vast and unexplored area. Obviously a lot to talk about, but I would like you to again tell me what it was you had in mind, since I do not remember the details. I think it's realistic to say that traditional publishing is out as far as my body of work is concerned, but I would like readers to have the opportunity to enjoy MRF. I think it's time to get a serious dialogue going on this, and I would appreciate your input. In the next two lines, he mentions two authors that he's reading, which are amazing to me that he's reading these guys at the end. But I'm currently reading David Copperfield. I just finished all of Proust. I'm trying to get as many of the big books read before I dive into the big sleep. Keep writing, Gary. Yes, I'm still writing, Gary, so I just wanted you to know. So. I'm going to introduce Dennis here in a second, but before I do, just so you all know, Gary was not here to sign his books tonight, but we have made a stamp. And after this tonight, please come up if you want to buy a book, which I hope you do. And Mike has a stamp he made using his signature, and we'll stamp your book. And so we can get your book signed by Gary Reilly. So next, I'd like to introduce Dennis Gallagher, Denver City Auditor. I had no idea Dennis knew Gary until Dennis showed up at Gary's funeral last year. Dennis was first elected to the Colorado House of Representatives in 1970. He served two terms, followed by 20 years in the state Senate. He also served two terms on the Denver City Council before being elected city auditor in 2003 and reelected in 2007. Dennis knows his fiction. He has a BA in English Literature and a Master of Arts degree. Dennis is the vice chair still of James Joyce Reading Society, and there's a good connection here because MRF, as you'll soon discover, has a few choice words for the man he refers to as Sunny Jim. Dennis.
Well, it's a joy to be here on this mystical evening, and I'm sure the people at Tattered Cover had no idea that this night that they picked for this reading would be the very night when Venus crosses in front of the face of the garish sun. Gary had something to do with that. No use in being Irish if you're not a little superstitious. But Gary was in my brother's class, and how many other classmates do we have here tonight? Could I see a show? Nick went to Regis, so you didn't. Anyway, Gary and my brother work for the Shamrock Painting Company, my father's attempt at entrepreneurology, and it lasted quite a while. And so I'm honored to be able to read a couple of pages here so you get a flavor of this wonderful book. And I don't believe the... it's in here where he comes home. The cabman, comes home, and the place he decides to pick his for hiding, and this is also a very special night because Tim Quinn and I are missing the James Joyce Metropolitan Irish Reading Society, which is meeting tonight. I tried to convince them all to come over here, but and to sort of get a new feeling for the Gary, who had the touch of James Joyce in his writing, but they're, you know how doctrinaire they are. And but anyway, the cabman, Murph, brings his money home, and then he sticks it in a copy of James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake book, because he knows nobody would ever steal that. That almost broke my heart. And then tonight, in the final line of the reading I'm giving you, he talks about how Latin didn't do him any good in high school. I object to that, Gary. And it certainly did you a lot of good. That's why your writings are so good, and I'd answer that across eternity. So this is from chapter 8, and get a load. And I had to take a cab recently to some meeting. I was running late, and I was telling the cabman about this story and about this evening, and he said, oh, work up a little flyer. So I passed out a bunch right near the city, the Sheraton there. So a lot of cab drivers are going to want to read this book, I hope, because Gary really captures it. So anyway, here's chapter 8, at least in the text I have. I pulled around the corner and parked my cab. I wanted to fill out my trip sheet and stow my cash. Just taking care of business, and as I tucked the 20 into my billfold, I hope I hadn't ruined the kid's life. I often hope that. Just so you know, I didn't start out driving cabs in college. That came after I dropped out of Dena Plex. Writers often incorporate the experiences of real-life acquaintances into their stories. So do liars. This is a great... Here's the name of the love. And as far as Mary Margaret Flaherty, get a load of that. That's my mother's maiden name. I'm sure he got that from my mom, who talked to him about the Flahertys. As far as Mary Margaret Flaherty not wanting to marry a dropout, well, that part was true. But I think it had more to do with her not wanting to marry an unpublished novelist. How long do you think it's going to take you to start making money at it? She asked me one night. We were courting at the time. I think the thing that tipped the scales against me was when I told her I didn't write for money. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that that's what made her pink cheeks go pale. I tried to explain that money either comes or it doesn't, but that a real writer is concerned only with his art. I read that in a book, a how-to book. Then she asked me how I intended to earn money so they could afford to buy a house after they got married. That made my own cheeks go pale. But I don't want to go into the details of the big breakup. I'm somewhat of a fan of minimalism in literature, so the verb nosedive ought to sum it up. Isn't that great? As an aside, did you know the word verb is a noun? Don't ask me to explain it. Just ask Franz Kafka. I drove along 38th Avenue, back toward downtown Denver, and tried not to look at the demolished Ehlich site as I headed east. 20 years ago, after I first came to Denver, Ehlich's amusement park was where I went at night when I was broke, lonely, and looking for cotton candy. The Ehlich Theater is still standing. I once saw Mickey Rooney come out of the theater. He was starring in a play. After the show ended, he came striding out the side door with a big grin on his face and headed for the parking lot. I froze. Mickey, star of silent movies, talkies, frequent guest on Steve Allen. I didn't even think to ask for his autograph. He was gone in an instant. Mickey Rooney fascinates me. And my brother was with him that night when they saw Mickey at the Ehlich's. I drove as far as Fox Street, then cut across the viaduct past the Rockies baseball stadium and found myself cruising along Wynkoop Street in the direction of Union Station, full circle, standard operating procedure in a taxi. When I drove up past the Oxford Hotel, I started thinking about Tony, the barber. Why was he at the Hilton again? When Gino had asked me what Tony was doing there, I got a funny feeling that Tony wasn't supposed to be anywhere near the place on Monday. I couldn't block out the image of Tony looking into the taxis like he was looking for a familiar face. My face. I hate it when people look for me. Sergeants were always looking for me in the army. Sergeants with mops. But back then, I figured all I had to do was hide out for 2 years, and I was home free. It worked. I decided to park at the Fairmont Hotel cab stand. I pulled up, fourth in line. I shut everything off, my engine, my two-way radio, my AM radio, and my paperback. I sat there, watching the front door. The doorman at the Fairmont is named Jules. He was doing his doorman dance, directing porters, greeting guests, opening cab doors, and discreetly pocketing tips. Doormen and cabbies have a lot in common, except the doormen wear white gloves and classy long coats with brass buttons. You never really get chummy with hotel doormen, but palace guards and asphalt warriors respect each other and do each other favors as the occasion arises. There is an honor among men who thrive on tips. I pointed that line out to the doorman at the Oxford Hotel tonight as I came here. They liked it. I get along well with both Jules and Francois. On a number of occasions, I have escorted slobbering drunks out of the Hilton bar at the request of Francois and driven them home. In return, he sometimes passes the word along if a group of guests are planning a trip to Vail or Aspen. I took a group of skiers to Vail one winter day many years ago, and it turned into the trip from hell. I don't want to talk about it. An elderly couple came out of the hotel. I cruised up to the door. Jules leaned down to my window and said, somewhat apologetically, they want to go to Larimer Square. Now, Larimer Square is only a few blocks away. Normally, this would have annoyed me, but I just grinned at Jules and nodded. This was one of those favors I mentioned, but subtle if you don't know what I mean. No whining. Doormen hate it when cabbies whine, but who doesn't? The next time I showed up, Jules might deal me a guest headed for the Grand Canyon. We're from Chicago, the woman said brightly after she and her husband settled down in the back seat. The home of the Hawk, I said as I started the meter. The Windy City. They seemed to like that as I pulled out and asked if I would drive them around downtown before dropping them off. They had never been to Denver before. I hauled them over to the Capitol building so they could look at the massive dome and authentic gold leaf. The woman pulled a Nikon out of her purse and snapped a picture for my grandchildren. I gave them a quick narrative of Denver history, making up parts I was unsure of. Sort of like current historians that I know. I had gotten B in my history class at UCD, but that college course about Denver's past had come in handier than any Latin class I had ever taken in high school. So that gives you a flavor of this wonderful book. Enjoy it.
I think we have time for a few questions. Mike, if you want to help me out here. And some of them may go to the family, I don't know. But I think we got time for a few questions. They close at 9 tonight, so got a few people to...
Yeah, we have to have a little time for this.
Yeah, but...
Yeah, any questions?
Any questions? Lisa.
22 books. Do you have plans to publish all 22?
Yeah. We do. it depends. If it starts like this and continues like this, you bet. The next one comes out in 6 months. It's already been edited. The artwork's been done for the cover. So we're pressing ahead.
And the publisher is insistent that we get to number 3 because I know Linda and Myra both think the 3rd is really, really good, and we do too. So
yeah.
Got to get there at least,
over
if not
here.
Further. Yeah.
What inspired you to write about taxis and cabbies?
Well, it was Gary. He was a cab driver, and so he had that experience, and a lot of his work was... Most of his work was based on experience. He also did other things too. He wrote some science fiction, fantasy type stuff. He tried noirish thrillers, kind of in the like James Caine. So he was all over the place. But the cab stuff is really Gary disguised as Murph.
Why do you think he was so reticent?
I think that he didn't think he was ready. He went back, he revised books over and over again, and he just didn't want to have something out there in the world that he was not proud of.
books and his humor being an antidote for the times. And I wish either of you could expand on that.
Once you've read all 9 or 10, it's just over and over. His two main goals in life are to never earn more money than it takes to keep his very bohemian, simple life, afloat. He really doesn't want extraneous money. In fact, I was going to read a passage from David Copperfield tonight, where one of the characters tells David Copperfield about misery versus happiness, and if you are in debt, it's miserable. And that was Merv's whole thing in life. He just wanted to keep his finances simple. He wanted to go home every night and cook his burger and wash his dish, and he liked to cruise the television and pick up old reruns of Gilligan's Island. His needs were very, very simple, and I think he's really an antidote. He's anti-materialism. He's about life, and ultimately he spends all of his energy helping others.
The book that follows that one?
No, they all kind of like in order before.
Yeah, they do.
They'll
all be, the same design, essentially. And the second book is Ticket to Hollywood. And I think the third is Dr. Lovebeads. Is that right? Yeah, that's a real high point. That's really terrific, they're all over the place. But they're all centered with Murph as a taxi cab driver in Denver. He gets off in other places occasionally, but it's very Denver-centric. Good. Why don't we go to stage 3?
All right.
Whatever that is.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I can't let these two gentlemen get away with this without something from the family. I'm Gary's sister, Joanne, and I'm going to force my sisters and brothers to stand up, and they're going to love this. Craig is the oldest. Craig is from Lincoln, Nebraska. Dan is the second oldest. Dan came from San Jose, California, Mountain View. Gary was next in line, then Marilyn. Marilyn's from Kearney, Nebraska. Our sister Peg Ondrock could not be here. She's in Kearney, and she could not get away today, thanks to her daughter's wedding. Then there was myself, Joanne, and then our younger sister, Judy. And last of all, Tim is over here.
And the fact that we won't sit together is not a reflection of that.
And the most important person in the room tonight is Sherry Peterson. You will stand up. Stand up, please. Well, Sherry was the love of Gary's life. They lived together for, I think about 40 years. And just to give you some idea of what Gary was like, he was a hermit, he was reclusive. He was one of the most generous and loving and hilarious guys in the world, but Gary didn't need a lot of attention, but he needed Sherry very much, and she was the most wonderful thing in his life, and we love being able to be here with her tonight because this is for Sherry. I think it was always for Sherry, even if Gary didn't cook much and didn't earn a living and let her take care of him. And when he had cancer, she had been an oncology nurse, and she is an RN, and she took care of our brother until his death, and we are grateful. But he had these two amazing friends, Mark and Mike, who have done what I don't think any two other friends would ever do. People would try to give you peace at your deathbed and say, yes, we'll publish your 20 unpublished books, but who does that? And these two guys are phenomenal. And Gary didn't know how to choose his friends. He couldn't choose his family, and I know he regretted that. But we all inherited his sense of humor, and Mom and Dad would be proud. We were a motley crew, in my mom's words. But Mike and Mark were unbelievable in doing what they promised at Gary's funeral. And I remember that years ago, about 15 years ago, we had a Riley family reunion up at Fort Robinson in western Nebraska, and Dan called Gary to ask if he was going to come, and Gary just said in Gary-esque tone, "I don't do family reunions." And all I could think of tonight as I sit here listening to his dear friends who got him published, he would say to Sherry, "Well, have fun. I don't do book readings about my books." So, Gary, this is for you. We love you. We love Sherry. We love Mike and Mark, our two new brothers, and we hope they will accept us in their family because they're stuck with us. But thank you all for being here. You don't know what this has done for us. We really appreciate you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.